Though I suspect some of the people who were here for as long as anyone knows in Alaska may have come over from Asia. Who knows? No? No, wrong.
Maybe I can give you
please
at least a Native perspective. I think if you look at the names of all of Native peoples, the names for themselves, it usually means real human beings as opposed to others.
I think the only absolutely safe designation might be indigenous peoples, as someone in the audience suggested, but I think if you say Native people, or Aboriginal people.
Just one brief comment also.
It's going to be a long afternoon, beginning this morning.
When you attempt to say arrivals from the, then you are following a theory that is controversial about the bridge.
I raise it as a question, right? I have no evidence.
And you will find many indigenous people of the lower 48 and here that are saying we did not come over on the bridge. We were here. We were, again, in relationship to the rights of trees, rocks, and whatever. And we were made from this earth here, and perhaps went that way. Okay. And now you're coming back.
Fine. Okay. Well, it seems to me that common sense and decency requires that every man and woman be called by the name by which he or she wishes to be called. You want to be called indigenous peoples? That's all right. It just makes my speech a little longer. Okay. So there is a sense of separateness and specialness that seems to be connected, and a pride in that. But as I said, referring to that excerpt from the testimony in 68, there were other things that were wished for as well. And the author, I won't say fudges, but leaves open the question whether those other things were ranked in any particular fashion. It seemed that, among other things, the indigenous people wanted to have prosperity. They wanted to have an equal opportunity in the larger society around them. They wanted to have liberty from governmental supervision and harassment. They wanted to have a voice in things that concern themselves. And though this has not come up much in our oral discussions in today and yesterday, it certainly was prominent to me in reading the paper and its account of earlier records. There was a desire for higher expectations for themselves and especially for the children. So these are large objectives. What renders the thing especially interesting, though, to me at any rate, and problematic, is the way in which these indigenous peoples express their ambivalence toward the things that white society can offer and the things that come along with having to deal with white society. I'll just call whites whites, even though there are many kinds there. Okay. I mean, well, but you see, that's the other side of it. But I'm speaking of, the corresponding side of the white effort to reduce a great heterogeneity into one lump, okay, and not care or notice differences that are significant to those people, is reciprocated on the other side by a great lumping of the others, and we just call them whites. Okay. But I won't worry about that part of it. I was speaking of this ambivalence. The white world carries with it all kinds of comforts, all kinds of conveniences. The whites also are the bearers of subsidies and grants. They've got the money. Now, this isn't a new thing. It's an old thing. I speak with full awareness of what I don't know about anthropology or about the Algonquian peoples and so on. Somewhere along the line there, somebody noticed that it was better to have an iron pot if you were going to be on the move from time to time than an earthenware one. Somewhere along the line, somebody noticed that you might have a better chance to capture game if you had a flintlock. So there was a great deal of adoption and a great, I would even say, lust for certain kinds of white goods. I'm not talking about trinkets now and stuff like that. I mean, things that had to do with living at all. So there's this mixture of attraction and repulsion. Somewhere along the line, some Indians in the East must have noticed that in adopting the white man's technology, they were at one and the same time liberating and enslaving themselves. Once you switch from bows and arrows made out of local materials or available on easy trading from wherever it is you get it, to flintlocks, you need powder, you need lead, you need replacement parts. You're now beholden. And you may be beholden in a way that really essentially incapacitates you for living the way you used to live. So you're confronted then with something that is both a seduction and a corruption. I mean, reading these things, and it comes up in a variety of ways. There's a sort of summary statement in Reardon's paper about what's been the result since ANCSA was set in motion. Well, certain things have happened. Health services have been much improved, yes. The economic level of a variety of peoples has markedly been raised. But there's the same amount or more, it wasn't clear to me, of drunkenness, drug addiction, and you don't have to travel far. One block from the nice hotel that they've put us up at is 4th Street, or whatever it's called. And you see the flotsam and jetsam of any city. It wasn't clear in reading these papers or in hearing the accounts of the testimony whether these people were happier. And indeed, it wasn't clear what would constitute happiness for these people. They're very much betwixt and between. Another thing, and connected with this whole business of, I've got to say, what is an Indian, what is an Aleut, what is a this, what is a that? The special effort that these sundry Aboriginal people Aboriginal people are making to maintain their identity isn't clear to me what's indispensable and what's desirable. And I'm not saying that this is a result of a confusion in these people's minds. I think it's a question to which there are no easy answers. and not facing the question doesn't make it easier to find out what would be a satisfactory answer to this or that particular individual or group of individuals. There's language. There's religion. There are customs. There's this thing that some people in papers call culture. There's land. Now, most of the talk around here has been about the land, but obviously it's not just real estate. That's been brought out again and again, Mr. Naranjo's remarks and others. Okay. It's not just turf, it's a certain kind of connection between some area and that whole body of meanings and significances that people impart to it, their way of seeing it, their way of looking at it, that may be connected as much with the very words they use as with their customs and so on. That the language carries something of that. And I suppose, in a way, no one has said much about it, or at all. I may have missed it. One wonders, will the children or the children's children speak the language? Or will they speak it the way they could learn German or French or Spanish in high school? You know, something that you pass an exam for. Now, I'd venture to say, and this may strike you as bizarre, I don't think that this problem, which is, I believe, a critical problem and maybe the most fundamental problem that you have, is a peculiarly Indian or Aleut or Eskimo problem. I don't think there's anything special about your being the people that you are that makes this problem especially acute and troublesome. And I could give you some examples, rather bizarre examples, thinking of sitting in Alaska here, of just from my own observation. First, let me say, with no hint of any suggestion that I would want to embarrass anyone, just looking at people here, indigenous people, descendants of indigenous people, one is impressed by how betwixt and between people are. The dress, the language, straddling two worlds, as Mr. Naranjo said, a part of two worlds. I'll give some examples to show that there is nothing peculiar about this. This your local manifestation of this problem. Going through the Negev in southern Israel. These black woolen tents out on in this utterly desolate landscape. Woman herding goats, camels, and what have you. Parked next to the black tent, a pickup truck. Okay, that's your Bedouin. He travels freely in wartime and in peacetime between the land claimed by Israel and the land claimed by Egypt. Makes no difference. His herds go where they go. When he comes into town on Thursday morning in Beersheba, he's trading whatever he's trading, goats, women, whatever, in the traditional manner. But he'll be wearing a psycho watch, or what purports to be a psycho watch, digital. And he's got a truck. Where is he? Chicago is a large Indian city, but it's also a city with a large population of Appalachian people. They are very much betwixt and between.
Chicago is a large Indian city.
It has a large population of Indians.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yes.
Sorry.
Up in uptown. These Appalachian people have another world from which they have been dislocated, or which they've voluntarily or involuntarily left temporarily in the big city. Well, I don't know if they've relocated at all. Relocated suggests that you found a location. One has the sense of their transience, though they may live there for many years. You can go to New York, in Brooklyn, and see an area of town called Williamsburg. And it's filled with tens of thousands of people who wear late 17th, early 18th century Polish costumes. They're carrying attaché cases. They're completely plugged into, as they say, the world of microprocessors and so on. Yet they speak another language. They have another, quote, culture. They have another religion. They're betwixt and between. And they take extraordinary efforts, with a high degree of success so far, at maintaining their children in traditional ways. They're called Hasidim. Chicago is also a city with a sizable proportion of Lithuanians who still believe that it is a Lithuania, notwithstanding the convenient agreement between Russia and Germany that gave it away. They try to preserve the language. They dance Lithuanian dances. They wear Lithuanian costumes. And there's a Lithuanian newspaper. Will their children's children be Lithuanian? There's no land here. I mean, there's the idea of the land. And then I'm glad that finally today somebody mentioned blacks, who've got their own special problems, but who in a way share this, perhaps more acute in the case of those who are middle-class blacks and move simultaneously in the world of whites and affluence. So I mentioned all this only, out of my own observations of people who I think bear the burden that the indigenous peoples here bear. And I think with equal difficulty and embarrassment and uncertainty and misgiving. But of course, there is a special side to the indigenous people's problem. And that has to do with the complications that are owing to the very peculiar history that existed between, I'll speak loosely now, reds and whites in American history. And Mr. Chamberlain can speak for the continent if he wants. I'll just talk about the U.S. a little bit. Listen, it's noon. Do you want me to continue? Because this is a natural break, in
well,
a way.
Well, that's excellent. Then might I just make one observation before we break? And no doubt you're getting to this. There is a feeling, I think, among non-native Alaskans, and it can be found everywhere on the continent, that Alaska Natives are just another minority with their own particular history, but that history must inevitably lead to integration, if not assimilation, with the dominant white, middle-class, essentially Anglo idea of what people are and how they spend their lives and what language they speak and what society is all about. The notion being that, like the Ukrainians and the Irish and the Lithuanians, they will inevitably ascend the ladder of class and education, and that is what they ought to aspire to. In that sense, and I think that's a view widely held, but it is one that I think is rejected by Native Americans and Native Canadians and Alaska Natives. And it is one that confounds some of our notions of liberal democracy and the views that I think are taught in the classroom throughout the continent, and creates, I think, some confusion is the right word in the minds of the majority of Americans and Canadians about the appropriate place of Native people in the scheme of things. Well, forgive me for mentioning that, but you may come to it, and others among you may come to it, because I have no doubt that Mr. Lerner has thus far given us much to discuss this afternoon, and we expect to have even more. Could we adjourn then and come back at 1:15? Let's aim for 1:15. Would that be all right?
Well, they don't have one.
Yeah. Well, I think we're all assembled again, so we can turn to Professor Lerner again. I don't think your cheering section has returned altogether, but we'll insist that you carry on anyway.
I don't think it was a cheering section. It was more like a Greek choir. Okay, chorus. Okay.
Well, they were good humored anyway.
Right. Okay. Maybe I should simply state as I don't know if it's as pithily as I can, but anyway, more briefly than I did, the main point I tried to bring up in my earlier remarks under the general question, what is an Indian? That I thought that was a question here that was stirring. I gave examples that might have struck you as bizarre, though somebody came up just a few minutes ago to give the testimony of one who was descended from Lithuanians, that there is indeed something to it. And I have it on the hearsay of my older son that there are old believers in a place called Anilchik, if I haven't got it all wet, who somehow manage to adhere to their ways. And Mr. Naranjo spoke in what I thought was an especially revealing manner of a more than accidental combination of preservation of Pueblo identity, and no electricity. I think, if I didn't mistake him, he meant to suggest that they were related in some fashion. But in a more general way, I would say that the whole way in which we speak about these things or don't speak about them while thinking about them always is very different from the way in which your grandparents and mine would have dealt with this issue. They didn't speak or think of culture, belief systems, ideologies, and all the other debris of fancy terminology. They simply lived their lives, and it wasn't problematic. You can say you can't go home again. That's another matter. But looking at this magazine of Inuit 383, Inuit Arctic Policy Review, many things could be said about these resolutions and their inherent self-contradictoriness. But perhaps it's just enough to say that in this article by Philip Lauritsen, the Canadian organizers are praised for having organized things perfectly. And there were full houses each evening at the local Nakasuk school for performances ranging from drum and throat songs to Eskimo country and Western and rock. That speaks volumes. I ended up last time saying that for all those aspects of what I'm loosely calling here red-white relations that are analogous to things that happened to other peoples in many places of the world and even today, or especially today, there are special circumstances, it seems to me, that give extraordinary poignancy and complexity to these indigenous peoples' problems, because there's a special history. And I'll speak now of Indians and the United States government. In a variety of ways, there's been some notice or mention of the peculiar difficulty that whites seem to have had in thinking about Indians. Most of the things that I've read in the papers here or seem to have heard in the discussion suggest that the thing to know about it was that it was exploitative, unfeeling, at best misguided. I want to add to that picture because I think to the extent that we try to go back to the roots of that history or its earliest stages, the way in which Mr. Coulter and others suggested we might, we can get a kind of clarity about things that the present buildup of litigation and complicated papers and position papers and posturings and all that prevent us from seeing. We can see them more clearly if we go back to the origins. And in a number of respects, one sees there what one can find again today. It's still hanging around. I want to suggest that there was a terrific moral ambiguity in the white stance toward the Indians. and that in the case of the most thoughtful and best white leaders, that moral ambiguity was conscious and present to their minds. The large and pressing necessity of any white leader who was elected popularly, whether you're speaking about colonial officials or federal officials and state officials under the Articles of Confederation or under the United States Constitution, the first and foremost necessity was to get land. That was in no way negotiable. They were going to get the land. The question was how, under what conditions, what kinds of procedures, and they thought, and also at what speed, because there was a powerful national interest in not simply saying to the population, in effect, go get it, every man for himself. There was a great interest in controlling the speed and character of Western expansion, a great white interest in it. But given that leading necessity, as the whites saw it, there was another consideration. And as I said, I believe that the best and most thoughtful white leaders understood also that this was a question of national character. Let's say, what kind of a character would this people, the white American people, the Anglo-Americans, if you will, what kind of a character would they have? How they dealt with the Indians would reflect powerfully upon that character. Now, whether this was a vain conceit on the part of the Anglo-Americans, that they were better than other people, or that they ought to be better than other people, that's another matter. But they thought that they had something to live up to. The kinds of questions that we're talking about here at these meetings are simply not publicly raisable in most parts of the world. I think that's a massive fact. Not just because the ruling authorities would put their thumb on it, yes, but because there is no public consensus that one ought to deal with people who are in a weaker position than yourself in a way that isn't simply an expression of force. This is not an argument that can be dealt with in terms of Spanish law in Spain under their most Christian majesties, Ferdinand and Isabella. And it's not a law that can be raised under the law, under the rules of the Romanovs or of their Bolshevik successors in discussing the problems of minorities in Central Asia. I found it rather naive, and not charmingly naive, that somebody at this conference wondered about Soviet authorities not permitting. Circumpolar has a big gap in it. There's a large arc of that polar region that isn't there at this conference. They would not be Inuit from Siberia would not be able to take part in the conference because there were concerns about, quote, political undertones at the conference. And then somebody says he really is at a loss to understand the paranoia that prevents the Soviet government from allowing participation, a kind of cultural exchange. It's not paranoia at all. The Russians are on the verge of becoming a minority in their own country. Those aren't questions that can be raised there. We raise them here because of certain peculiarities in American law, in American experience, and if you will, in American hypocrisy, that make these questions always on the agenda, even when they're being grossly violated. For example, holding black men in chattel bondage. Nobody pretended that black men weren't men. And I venture to say that nobody in America thought that the Indians were men because Vitoria or Las Casas or the Pope said so. These were not authorities for Americans. Certainly not the Pope in New England. So it's an issue of national character here that say what kind of a people would the Americans appear to be to a world precisely because of the differences between those Anglo-Americans and these Indians. And it's a difference that turns on this massive fact that the Indians that the Anglo-American settlers were confronting in eastern North America were extremely vulnerable. When I say vulnerable, I don't mean that they weren't dangerous to white people. They were. But they were vulnerable in ways that made it a very uneven match. And not just because of the technology. Some of that vulnerability is reenacted before our very eyes in the lives of people whom we see, and in the lives of their children. The Inuits getting together in assertion of their cultural integrity don't find it unseemly, superfluous, to have rock and roll. Rock and roll is everywhere. Well, let's move now to some of the things that have been said about those relations. And there's been certain use of words that I find extremely problematic. And I don't speak as a lawyer because I'm not a lawyer. But a word of very great moment and significance has been used, and I believe in ways that are more likely to be misleading than helpful. One such word is sovereignty. I don't believe that it is or has ever been a question of Indian sovereignty. The Indians were not regarded either by the British colonizers, the British imperial power, the Privy Council, or by the Continental Congress, or by the Congress of the United States as sovereign political entities. The Indians were not the same as France or Spain. That they treated with them, that they used the language of treaty, is a fact. But what treating means is not so obvious. Treat means to deal with someone. Some people in the 18th century objected to using the very term treaty because of that ambiguity, that it gave Indians the notions that they were indeed a separate sovereign people. That wasn't the case. Whatever the Indians might think. But on the other hand, the Indians were not in the position, say, of French people who were living in the Louisiana Territory when the United States bought that through treaty from Napoleon. They weren't in the position of Spaniards living in Spanish Florida when the United States got that, because when those land transfers were affected, those people simply came directly, plainly, under the control of the United States government. They were persons to whom the Constitution reached. In no more complicated a fashion than it reached any other white person living within the confines of the United States. So the Indians are something in between. Foreign nations, relations with whom would fall under the responsibility of whoever at that time was the predecessor of Secretary Brzezinski, and people who were simply part of the whole American population. The American Constitution provided separately for Indians because the Americans had no right to convert Indians into American citizens. Whether they regarded it as a boon or as, I mean, whether it's a promotion or a demotion, doesn't matter. The fact is that the American government had no authority to rule the Indians directly while they were those separate peoples. On the other hand, the Indians were not in a position to treat themselves as a separate nation, entitled to have foreign relations with the King of England or the King of Spain or wherever, even while situated within the political boundaries of the United States. The boundaries all fell within one government, and you had people within it. These were not foreign enclaves in the sense that they could conduct their own foreign policy, make war or not, as the case suited them. Now, it's this quite anomalous, bizarre situation that leads to the embarrassments and the complications and the ingenuity and the contradictions and the hemming and hawing that has been the sum total of, quote, Indian law under the Constitution. Now, several times Johnson v. McIntosh has been mentioned, along with other important cases settled by the Marshall Court, Worcester v. Georgia and Cherokee Nation. In one sense, they're very simple. Very gross acts of injustice have been committed, and there's an effort to try to find a remedy. You don't have to go to college to know that there's something really wrong in the incidents that led to that litigation. But how to deal with it? The fact that you've got a question doesn't mean that you've got an answer. And yet the law requires that if there's been a wrong, there's got to be a remedy. This is what Marshall is struggling with. And he comes up with this strange thing about Indians as being domestic dependent nations within the boundaries of the United States. That states, I think, with tolerable clarity some of the problem and some of the actual situation. They are domestic nations. They are within the United States. They can't go off their own way. They can't, for example, vote to annex themselves to another principality. They're dependent. They have to live within the broad limits of American policy. If the United States goes to war, they can't proclaim themselves neutral. They can't serve as as Switzerland within the boundaries of the United States. But on the other hand, they are not simply for the United States to do with whatever it pleases. He's struggling with that kind of problem. The United States, for example, cannot, if I read Marshall correctly, just take away their land. He has to deal with them in some way. Those treaties, by the way, those early treaties, did not have to be and weren't ratified by the Senate the way it does under its treaty power. Washington raised that question in 1790. I've got an Indian treaty here. Do you need, what's your opinion? Remember, everything has to be worked out from scratch. They're square one. What do I do with Indian treaties? Do I submit them to the Senate? The Senate said, no, you don't have to submit it. Now, I think it was Mr. Coulter or Mr. Case who mentioned the business about the right of discovery and so on. In Johnson and McIntosh, Marshall goes over the various kinds of claims that European imperial powers made to the title to Indian land. He tells about the discovery thing and he ridicules it. By that token,